a great pleasure to be here. I had some doubts about Australia, to tell you the truth. See, back in the 50s, when I was about 54, 55, I think, I planned to look it up. At that time, ordinary language philosophy, something called ordinary language philosophy, was at its height. And Analysis used to have a competition on some subject, the British magazine. And one competition was really won by a parody of ordinary language philosophy. The winner won with an essay called The Logic of Australia Talk. And in this parody, it was explained that many people are misled by the logical form of Australia sentences to believe that Australia is the name of a place. And that really, of course, this is a very bad mistake, analogous to thinking that if I say I did it for Mary's sake, and I did it for an object, which is her sake, and ask, well, where is her sake? Show me her sake, and so on. In fact, in Australia is a sentential operator, meaning not in reality. So, for example, we say, in Australia, winter is in August, meaning in reality, winter is not in August. And we say, in Australia, there are black swans, meaning in reality, there are no black swans. And I thought of certain additions to this, like in Australia, contradictions can be true. So I was a little worried about getting on a plane to Australia. But being in Australia turned out to mean not being in reality. But I'll leave you to judge whether I am or am not tonight in reality. Now, to give you a little orientation on what I'm going to do in these six lectures, not all of them will, in fact, be on philosophy of mind, but as I think by the end you will see, they are all interrelated. These are the titles of the six lectures. As you'll see, tonight's lecture is called Misconstructing the Mind, and will deal especially with some famous views of Noam Chomsky's, more recently joined by Steven Pinker. The second lecture on non-scientific knowledge will move away from philosophy of mind to talk about issues, the idea that that it's a mistake to think that all of knowledge worthy of the name can or should aspire to live up to the standards and form of the exact sciences. That there's a great deal that we know that cannot be forced into that mold, and that we, and including importantly normative knowledge, knowledge of values, and I don't just mean ethical values, I mean epistemic values, values, and as you'll see, this idea that we will come back to these ideas when we come back to the philosophy of mind, because I want to argue that a lot of our exaggerated expectations from scientific models, from computational models, neurological models, and so on, valuable as those models are, as ways of understanding the brain, that there's lots about our mental life besides the brain, and that lots that cannot be, that is best, that is essentially interwoven, well, not to get ahead of my story, but that is essentially interwoven with normativity, with valuation, in short, interpretation. Then, in the third lecture, I will talk about skepticism. Again, that's the furthest I'll be from philosophy of mind. And then the last three will all be a continuous series on philosophy of mind, identity theory, the topics that Chris Mortensen mentioned. In terms of level of technicality, I'll try to make these accessible. Tonight's may be the hardest. Thursday's will be the least technical. So if you survive tonight, you should have an easier time. some time ago, my friend, the well-known American linguist Diane Bentari, said to me, I wouldn't find what I'm doing of any interest if I didn't believe that what we are doing when we study language is discovering something about the structure of the mind. Now, when I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, that was from 1944 to 1948, some of you may feel that's not in reality. Let's see. I fulfilled the course requirements for a major in three subjects, philosophy, German, and linguistic analysis. Linguistic analysis wasn't yet a department. It was Zelig Harris ran the program of linguistic analysis, and it had found a home as an autonomous subsection of the Department of Anthropology. And besides Zelig Harris, linguistic analysis consisted of two or three teaching fellows in anthropology, some other graduate students, and two undergraduates, Noam Chomsky and myself. And at that time, not one of us would have thought of saying that what we were doing was discovering something about the structure of the human mind. My friend's remark would have been literally unintelligible at that time. What has happened in the meantime is the appearance of a famous hypothesis called the innateness hypothesis. That is the hypothesis that the structure of language is innate in the human mind, and that the task of linguistics is to describe this innate structure. In later versions, Chomsky speaks of the innate language organ, or the innate system of modules. A module is a kind of miniature computer subserving language skills in the mind. This may have been implicit in Chomsky's Syntactic Structures, 1957. Actually, I'm not sure it was. I went back and looked at that again, and I can't really find any trace of the innateness hypothesis in Syntactic Structures, but maybe someone could interpret it in. But it certainly didn't become explicit until Chomsky reviewed Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior, in 1959, an epoch-making event. Now, this innateness hypothesis was not a new hypothesis about phenomena which were already recognized to be the subject matter of linguistics. If anything deserves the overused title of a paradigm change, it is Chomsky's innateness hypothesis. The mark of a paradigm change, or what French philosophers refer to as a coupure epistemologique, is that it doesn't simply offer new answers to old questions, but it rather changes our understanding of what the questions are. It makes it possible to ask questions that would previously have been unintelligible. That is exactly what the appearance of the innateness hypothesis did. It is not, I hasten to add, that all linguists, let alone all cognitive scientists, accept the new paradigm. But for those who do, the conception of linguistics, and increasingly the conception of cognitive science as well, is unlike anything that we have seen before, notwithstanding Chomsky's habit of claiming that Descartes and the rationalists were his forerunners. The structure of arguments for innateness. The general structure of arguments for innateness is as follows. The proponent of the innateness hypothesis describes a complex linguistic skill S that, he asserts, all children who are not severely retarded have the ability to acquire. Two, the process by which children acquire S is shown not to be one that learning theory can explain. That is, not to be one of the familiar mechanisms of learning theory, Hull or Skinner or even Estes, can explain. It's not, Chomsky showed, simply a matter, learning your language, your native language, is not simply a matter of schedules of reinforcement and stimulus generalization and response generalization and so forth, all those things that were taught by the textbooks of behavioral psychology when I was young. More precisely, Chomsky argues that if one widens the notions of stimulus, response, quality, space, etc., sufficiently so that one can regard the acquiring of S and like skills as an example of, quote, habit formation in the sense of standard learning theory, then one will have had to widen them in the process to such an extent that the explanations turn out to be empty. This strategy was brilliantly employed by Chomsky in the above-mentioned review of Skinner's verbal behavior. At one point, for example, he points out at one point when Skinner is explaining verbal behavior and meaning and reference, he has to refer to all of World War II as a stimulus. In the lectures he gave in Nicaragua, the Managua lectures, the title Language and the Problems of Knowledge, this was back in 1988, Chomsky argues convincingly that such familiar abilities as the ability of children to learn without explicit instruction, that the word book has both a concrete and an abstract sense. You know, I wrote three books, and there are 300 books in my library. are beyond classical learning theory. An example of a use of the word in the first sense is, this book weighs 2 pounds. An example of a use in the second sense is, John wrote this book. Another example used in the same lectures is the ability of children to learn that in such sentences as, who did John cause to shave himself? The original example was in Spanish. The reflexive pronoun himself, se, refers to the person John caused to shave and not to John, even though John is the name closest to the reflexive pronoun. The subtle explanation of this ability involves the presence of a, quote, trace, of an invisible trace of a pronominal object in the deep structure between cause and himself, even though this trace, as I said, is not visible in the sentence actually produced. Three, the same argumentative strategy was used by Steven Pinker. I'm referring now to Pinker's PhD thesis and to a long, published as a long article later on, to argue that the ability to acquire even such elementary features of English language as the past tenses of verbs cannot be explained by appeal to the idea that the brain is a connectionist architecture. This was important because connectionists had cited precisely the alleged ability of computers with connectionist programs to learn the past tenses of verbs as one of the great successes of that architecture. And what Pinker showed is that, yes, but the machines cannot learn exceptions. However, Pinker's arguments may not apply to more recent and more powerful connectionist architectures, I should add. Now, we have to disentangle the issues. That is the job of philosophers par excellence, from Socrates on. My purpose is not to review the empirical data or to challenge these conclusions. I take it that indeed classical learning theory is either bankrupt or empty as an explanation of the acquisition of complex linguistic skills. And I will not presume to decide whether connectionist approaches can succeed. But where do we go from there? Where Chomsky and Pinker go is to conclude that the ability of children to acquire these skills is explained by the alleged fact that the skills are innate. But first of all, let us ask what innate is supposed to mean. In Chomsky's own development, it has meant different things at different times. Early on, the idea of innateness was that the rules of universal grammar are represented in the brain. Thus, 20 years ago, Chomsky was happy to write, "With the progress of science, we may come to know something of the physical representation of the grammar and the language faculty. Correspondingly, the cognitive state involved in language learning and the initial state in which there is a representation of UG, universal grammar, but of no specific grammar corresponding to UG. The idea that there's a representation of universal grammar, whatever exactly that might mean, in the initial state was later dropped by Chomsky. He now says it is not necessary to suppose that the rules of the postulated universal grammar are themselves represented in the brain. It's only necessary to suppose that the brain is so composed that when it functions according to what he calls its competence, the speaker uses language in accordance with those rules, and that the difference between the surface grammars of the various natural languages can be explained by supposing that certain parameters get set differently as a result of speakers growing up in one linguistic environment or another. Thus, in 1988, we find him writing, "We may think of the language faculty as a complex and intricate network of some sort associated with a switch box, consisting of an array of switches that can be set in one of two positions. Unless the switches are set one way or another, the system does not function. When they are set in one of the permissible ways, then the system functions in accordance with its nature, but differently depending on how the switches are set. This fixed network is the system of principles of universal grammar. The switches are the parameters to be fixed by experience." That's a little like saying that a telephone switchboard is the system of principles of electricity. "The data presented to the child learning the language must be sufficient to set the switches one way or another. When these switches are set, the child has command of a particular language and knows the facts of the language, that a particular expression has a particular meaning," and so forth.